'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down that day. Looks like this time I'm gonna get to stay. I'm a union man now all the way. The smell of the leaves from the magnolia trees in the meadow. Harvest is surely come. A dry summer didn't come fall, which I depend on most of all. Hey, rainmaker, can you hear the call? Please let these crops grow tall. Long enough I've been upon skid row.
I always hate to cut that music off. I love it so much. You're tuned to WPKN, and this is the Organic Farm Stand, which comes to you the first and third Thursday of each month. Well, we were just talking to Guy Beardsley about the fact that it is approximately midwinter, and
Groundhog Day last Sunday.
That is right.
Yes.
And we got to some fairly encouraging news about the fact that the winter will not be a long and hard one from this point forward. Is that your assessment?
That's he didn't see his shadow when they opened him up for earlier in the morning. So that says it's not going to be six more weeks of winter.
Okay.
But if you want to take the groundhog, that's view on most matters.
I take it you're not a true believer on that one.
No, we've experienced, in my aged condition, I have experienced the fact that the groundhog may be 50% correct and 50%
so
wrong.
Flip of the coin.
Right.
Well, we're also blessed to have Guy's lovely daughter, Janelle Beardsley, is here. Janelle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Richard. It's great to be here.
We hope this is the start of a tradition, a pattern of behavior that you'll continue with us here each show. That'd be great to have you. So just a quick update on what we're going to be doing today, because each week things happen here. We have guests, we have discussions. After Guy Beardsley's small farm report, we're going to have our monthly bee report from Vincent Kay, who is the proprietor of Swords into Plowshares Honey. And he'll be here to talk about something amazing. I mean, it's always just a wild adventure when Vincent is on. So he'll be here in a few minutes. And then a special guest today, why don't you actually tell us who that is, Janelle? Because this is your production. You were right on it. You got in touch with this person. You know about all of it. In fact, you know a lot about biodynamic farming in general. So tell us what's going to happen at about 25 after.
Yeah, sure, Richard. Sherry Wildfoyer is editor of the amazing Stella Natura Biodynamic Planting Calendar. And this has been produced, printed, published out of Pennsylvania for more than 40 years. And it's an incredibly beautiful, useful, educational planting calendar that uses cosmic rhythms to inspire farmers and gardeners. And it is always has beautiful artwork on the cover and amazing articles for each month of the year. And Sherry Wildfoyer is the creator and founder and the editor of this amazing calendar. And she's going to tell us a lot about biodynamic agriculture and how she started this calendar based on some amazing experiences that she had as a gardener in the 1970s. So we'll hear from her from Pennsylvania, where she is at Kimberton Hills.
Fantastic. So that'll be happening before the half hour. And so let's launch, because we have so much to cover today. Guy,
yes, indeed.
What's going on at midwinter on the farm?
Yeah, absolutely midwinter, but we have not had a whole lot of snow on the ground. We did have about 3 inches for a bit, And what I always like to see is 4 inches, if we can, keep it on the ground, because that protects the soil and creates a nice warm environment for those seeds to come up, which of course includes a lot of weed seeds. But nevertheless, the garlic likes that sort of winter. And so we've had it, and let's hope we the woodchuck is correct, and that we will have more winter. We will have more spring. Anyway, the black garlic is still functioning, and Janelle and I have got 4-5 cookers going now. I think it's 5, Jill, right?
Five, yes.
Yes, 5 cookers going, and of course, each cooker takes 12 days or 288 hours to produce its magnificent crop of black garlic, which of course is one of those magnificent things that is in nature, and it is a tremendous boost to the immune system. And I always like to talk about the fact that one of our great customers is a nurse in a URI ward in Bridgeport Hospital, and by using 1 clove a day, she has been able to stay clear of any flu or cold during the entire winter, whereas all the other workers in there without the black garlic all had colds and or flu. How about that? Anyway, black garlic is magnificent. So, but beyond that, we're reporting that the lavender has withstood the winter so far really well. And the lavender does not like a whole lot of wet. But we've had plenty of rain, but not really recently. But we're going to have more now. And so we plant that lavender on raised beds so that we don't have a wet root problem. And so they don't live in the mud, because they can't live in the mud. So we're in the business of planning to take out our vineyard. We have about a half acre of vineyard, which is used to provide excellent grapes, but we're going to take it out, and we're going to go into further lavender in the vineyard. So that's what we're doing. We're also cutting out our old peach trees now. Some of those old peach trees, particularly all the white peach trees, because they are such a fragile peach for me, growing them organically, that I just don't want to fool with those white peaches anymore. My brother does a great job on white peaches, but he, of course, is not organic. And but he does a great job on all his fruit. Nevertheless, we're taking out all the old yellow as well as all the white peach trees. And we're going to getting our strawberry beds ready for planting. And, of course, the strawberries are still covered up, but we're getting those beds ready. And when it comes to blueberries, this is the time to make sure you're pruning the blueberries. You've got the weather to do it. And as a matter of fact, if you can get the pruning done before the middle of February, you would be good. But you can actually prune almost up until the time you get some blossoms. But we always like to leave the bushes create their own energy as much as possible once the mid-February starts, because that's when the sun is going to be at the angle and at the duration so that it starts to inspire growth in the ground. So that's one of the things which we take out. And we have a substance which we call blueberry booster. And I think, Richard, you've had some of that sometimes. You might need to stop by, or I need to bring some down to you next meeting, right?
Yeah, I think I might have a drop or two left, but
you'll need some more.
Tell us a little bit about Blueberry Booster.
So Blueberry Booster, it's called Blueberry Booster is created by Fedco. And Fedco puts a bunch of soil amendments in there. And all, of course, there's no manure type. It's all from crops and soils. And so it's just as a great thing. You put about a cup around each plant at the drip line of the bush. And you can You know, you put it in early enough. It's a little too early right now because you don't want to put it in until the sun gets to the midpoint of February. And then from that point on, then you can't put it in.
Do you just sprinkle it on the ground or do you have to mulch it in a little
bit? Yeah. Well, it doesn't hurt to if you want to scratch it in too. Mm-hmm. We usually have take some scratchers, hand cultivators, and scratch around the base of the plant anyway to get rid of all the weeds that are or that want to start growing there, and then put the blueberry booster around the drip line of the plant, but scatter it because it and so if you do that a good cup per bush, then it'll be give the bush all the nutrients that you need to have, because by the time the rains wash the blueberry booster down into the root area, then you'll be good, and you'll be able to tell a big difference between the bushes that you do and you don't put that booster on. So that's pretty decent. And beyond that, we're just ordering seeds and taking care of income tax activities, which is horrendous, particularly when you're in the LLC. There's a lot of paperwork to be done. Janelle has been of great assistance on that matter.
I love to file papers.
Oh, my God. Don't say that on the air. People will be calling you up.
That's right.
An organic, certified organic, enter into the IRS at all? I mean, is there any sort of cross wires there?
Well, the certification doesn't affect the IRS at all. Okay. The certification, however, is due on the 15th of March. And and we've looked at it, and we go, my son-in-law, Janelle's husband, is really good on this matter. And so he can take all our input and in a period of a couple of days, fill out the form and then put it online and get it out of the way. He's marvelous in that. He's real techie, as so is Janelle, for that matter.
Well, the big thing is paying the fee for the organic certification, and one of the years maybe we'll get reimbursed for that, but not yet.
Well, the state offers 75% repayment of the fee that you up to $750.
Is that right?
Yeah.
State of Connecticut.
The state
encourage organic farmers.
That's right. Well, the state gets funds for that too from federal government, but we work through the state on that. Yeah, and up through three quarters of your expense, up to $750, the state will be glad. But you have to fill out all kinds of forms, obviously. but you do that, and they'll be available, right?
Yeah. And Janelle is available, so.
Oh, absolutely right.
Now I am.
Right.
Well, that's a good moment. Should we break here and go on to the B report, or you got more for us?
I don't know. We could take Vincent about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ready
I think
for the
we
B report?
Can. Right.
Okay.
If Vincent's on.
Yeah, Vincent, stand by. So this may have been a somewhat foreshortened farm report, but I'll tell you, when Vincent is on and we have another guest coming, so we got to be kind of economical with our time. So let's do that. Let's welcome Vincent Kay to the microphones. Vincent joins us the first Thursday of each month with the special B report. Vincent, what kind of wild adventure are you going to take us on today?
Well, I think Guy was pretty accurate in that the weather certainly has been warm, and it affects plant growth and tree growth and shrubs, but it also affects bees. And that's a big mystery, right? You would expect it to. We have in the shop here where we bottle and process and extract the honey, we have a glass hive, which we keep alive all year round. And right now, I'm looking at the hive, and you can see the queen and the bees, and they're not trapped inside the hive. They can go out if they'd like. There's a tube through the wall, and they can come and go whenever they want. And on the nice days that we've had last week and this week, you'll see them flying a little bit outside just to gather some water and probably relieve themselves of defecation. And then they come back in, and they form a cluster, And the food is disappearing quickly. And I'm not sure they ever stopped raising brood, although they've reduced the size of the brood pattern, brood being the eggs that the queen lays, which means that they have to keep the temperature at a very high temperature inside the glass hive. And I use this hive as a barometer for what's going on in the field, out in the wilds where we actually keep hundreds of hives. It's somewhat different, but it within a week or so, it kind of actuates what's going on with the environment and predicts weather and shows a pattern if you look at it carefully every day, which we do. And so we're kind of confounded again. It could be a very early spring, which is a very dangerous spring for everyone, because the bees can run out of food, and that food is what they consume to create the heat inside the hive. And once they have a brood pattern going, they've got to keep that area inside the hive at 95 degrees, no matter what. It could be zero outside, but that little section of the hive will be at 95 degrees. That's what they need to incubate the eggs. It's just like chickens or birds. And so the danger is that they run out of food, or that the edges of the brood pattern get chilled or frozen because there's not enough bees to cover them. And, of course, in growing seasons, the danger is that things move ahead too quickly. And then later in April or even early May, we sometimes get a frost. And a lot of things can be damaged then within the trees and the orchards and even blueberry bushes and things like that. So we hope that it kind of stabilizes, although I'm not sure it's going to. But people this winter should have, or beekeepers should have, had a chance to look at their hives and see whether they're alive or not. Now, we lose hives every winter. I'm not going to say we don't. But we go in like detectives doing an autopsy, and we try to figure out why. The first thing we do is test for a number of diseases, and some of the bee catalogs and companies will sell fairly accurate chemistry test kits that you can use in a kind of a mobile lab on the back of the tailgate of your truck, and you can test for foul brood, American and European foul brood, things like this, which we always do in a bee yard if we've got losses. The first thing to look for is to make sure that they had enough food. I'm talking about a dead hive now. And then to also look at the cluster of bees which died inside the hive. And if it's a small cluster, it probably died or had death written all over it back in September. Something was wrong with the queen. Something prevented her from laying a large pattern of eggs, which would then hatch out and become the winter force to keep the hive warm. So that's one of the things to look for. There's nothing you can do except jump back on the horse in the saddle and order your bees and get ready to go again in the spring. However, if you have a hive, and this is one of the things we've noticed this year, the hives that are doing well, and we have a lot of them, and this is the scary part, is the clusters inside the hive are just way too big for this time of year. And so this means, again, that they're going to run out of food. So we've been monitoring the food like crazy. And sometimes you can take food from a hive that's died, provided there's no disease, and add it to the other hive that may need it to keep it going. It's a little early right now to be feeding sugar syrup because that syrup needs to be reduced by the bees. The moisture content needs to be evaporated. And that ends up using up more energy than you really want the bees to use, and it also changes the amount of moisture inside the hive and creates a chill factor. Of course, when you're wet and you go out into the wind, it's always much colder than if you're dry. So it's the same principle inside a hive, and that syrup will sometimes at this point do more damage than good. So that's why I say if you have a hive that has died and it's got sealed honey or a food, it's probably better to transfer those frames rather than to feed open sugar syrup.
What is
little tricks like that?
What is the food other than honey that is that you just referred to?
Mostly honey. But once they do start laying eggs, they do need to feed protein to the larva, and that protein is of course found in the pollen, which they also store with the honey. So the honey is the carbohydrate part. the pollen is the protein part. They need both, but especially when they start raising the brood.
Can you add, when you discover a hive that's low on honey or pollen, can you just rack some more in there?
You can on a nice day. Every time you open a hive in cold weather, a gush of warm air comes out, and they've got to start from scratch once you close it back up to create that thermal layer. So you try to do it on a nice day, and sometimes it's only an hour's worth of nice weather. But if you get 45 or 50 degrees and the hive is in the sun and they're somewhat active around the entrance or even flying here and there, it's okay to open it briefly. There are some companies that sell pollen substitute, which is not a bad thing to give them. It's kind of a patty or a cake form. It's kind of a paste, which is brewer's yeast and other things added, which are all very good ingredients. So you can supplement that. Again, there's no real supplement for honey. The open syrup, you can feed them as you get closer into warmer weather, but right now it can really do more damage than good. So we're trying our best to kind of mitigate, you know, hives that have just way too many bees in them right now. And it's not something we've created. It's just something that's a product of a warm winter. And I suppose if we can get them through, it's a good thing in the spring. We'll have a lot of bees to sell. But and we do that to some extent before we ship the hives into the orchards for pollination, which we do as part of the business. One of the other sort of things that's somewhat related to a warm winter is, and we may need to do this another at another time in another show, but I'll mention it now, is the black bear population in Connecticut. Normally, these critters go into hibernation if it's a normal cold winter, and you can kind of breathe for a month or two and say, okay, the bees are going to make it. You know, we can, you know, fix the electric fencing and kind of take care of the things that we need to. Right now, the bears have not been in hibernation. In fact, last week we had some snow out in Madison, and the tracks were circling, bear tracks were found in the snow circling the fence. So they want in, and thankfully the fence worked. But, you know, you've got to constantly make sure that the branches and sticks from windstorms don't short out the fencing. And these are all in remote locations, so they're all run by solar panels, and everything has to work just perfectly. And so far, knock on wood, they do or have. But this is a big problem for beekeepers in Connecticut, and maybe we can talk more about that on another show or something. But if we have time, I can get into it a little bit, Richard, but I don't want to take up other people's time.
No, I think it's a fascinating story, and it's an important story about why in southern Connecticut we're now seeing this explosion of bears. So why don't you briefly explain how that came about?
Well, yeah, it's similar to what happens in Connecticut when resources are kind of approached academically, and probably part of the financial solution of a budget that's you know, basically out of control and bankrupt. But what the state has done is put bears in certain breeding pairs of male-female bears in certain parts of the state, and this has happened through their wildlife division. It's well documented.
This is DEEP, right? Department
correct.
Of Environmental and Energy and Environmental
Protection. Correct. But they've moved these bears in order to create a population which will grow and become a nuisance to the point where it seems more acceptable, perhaps, to open a hunting season on them, and thus they can then sell licenses to the public and raise revenue. This is well documented. These bears didn't come down out of Litchfield because there's too many bears having a good time up there. These are actually placed in certain forests. Utility companies have allowed them to happen on their property. And, you know, for whatever it's worth, the state legislature did maybe the right thing this year. I mean, we don't want to have to euthanize a bear, but they did, the state legislature in Hartford did vote that we can protect our hives if we're being attacked by bears or the bears are attacking the bees. And so far, the fences seem to be working just fine. But that, at least, but farmers have against the destruction these bears can create.
Oh, my God. Okay, that I just created a terrible mess there because I disconnected Vincent. Let me see if I can get Vincent back, and then I was trying to get our next guest on the phone, but screwed it up badly. So let me try one more time to get Vincent back, and if you folks would...
we'll continue, right.
Right. That's very interesting. The current Stella Natura calendar has... three articles about bees.
Yes, it does.
In the spring and early summer months. Three that explain some of the biology of bees and how they reproduce.
Please leave your message for...
I read that, too, and it just verifies what Vincent says about the bees and the winter, the temperatures, but it's astounding that they have to have a 95-degree temperature, because that's the sort of temperature we have to keep for young turkeys, too. Yeah, it was really hot for the first 2 weeks or so, actually not quite 2 weeks, but until they start to get operational. Yeah, what I was going to ask Vincent on as sort of a stupid little question was, has anybody ever developed a pet bee? And it seems like I read some articles that somebody had a pet fly at one time. I'm just wondering if they ever had a pet bee or if a bee's disposition would allow such things. Kind of a strange situation, but so if you get a bee to crawl around on you without stinging, that that might be an incentive to do something, which is a terrible idea, really, because it's a bee is a wild creature and should be handled as a wild creature, just like you'd never turn your back on a bull. Right.
Well, bees have been cared for and developed by human beings for millennia, and they're, as we know, essential to most of what is in the produce section of the grocery store.
Yeah.
That is...
Well, anyway, that's what that article that he has on bees is really very, very... It's for whatever the space it would take you, time it take you to read that article is best spent if you want to know anything about bees. This is all you really need to know about bees, which is right there in Shelley's calendar. Sherry's calendar, right. So I think Richard's get Sherry on the horn there. Right. But anyway, that's anybody that's interested, that Stella Natura calendar, which can be obtained through Amazon and through most good stores that are bookstores, right? Because and you want to get the one early in the season, like January and February, because it's got tremendous information, which we're going to find out about. How are we doing with Sherry?
Well, first of all, I want to apologize to Vincent Kay for that abrupt curtailment of our conversation, which was fascinating. He did introduce the topic of bears, and we'll continue that next time, because I think it's amazing that, you know, for the few bucks that the DEEP could raise on bear hunting licenses, they have created a situation where homeowners and beekeepers and probably small farmers are now confronted with an exploding black bear population in the southern part of the state. So, pretty hilarious but disturbing commentary there from Vincent. Thank you so much, Vincent Kay, and we will take up that conversation with you in the first Thursday of March. My God, is it March already? But now it is our pleasure to introduce Sherry Wildfarer, who is here to tell us about the Stella Natura calendar. And Janelle, why don't you take it from there?
Sherry, hello. And there in Kimberton Hills, Pennsylvania, thank you for joining us on the Organic Farm Stand. You have been editor of Stella Natura since 1978. That's amazing. How did you get into this?
Well, I was
introduced to the work of Rudolf Steiner and biodynamics when I was 18 years old in 1966. And since there was no formal biodynamic training in America, there were some farms and gardens, but I wanted to learn more, so I went when I was 21 to Switzerland to work in a biodynamic garden at the worldwide center of what's called the anthroposophical movement that Rudolf Steiner's work is called anthroposophy. And my job in the garden included replicating an experiment by Maria Thun, who was a German biodynamic farmer who had followed up a statement in Rudolf Steiner's lectures on agriculture that it makes a difference to plants when one sows the seeds, according to the influences that are streaming down from the universe at that time. And he said one would have to develop a science of these things. So she decided to plant radishes every day and to record the difference in their growth to try to find the correlation between the growth patterns and the cosmic events. And it took her a long time. Radishes, by the way, are like the mice in plant experiments because they grow so fast. And you can let them go to seed in the very same season. So you can really see different aspects of the growth in one season. And she finally observed these different growth patterns every few days, and that there was a correlation between plants that had particularly strong roots with when the moon was in front of the three Earth constellations. I'll explain that a little bit later. And when there was more vigorous leaf growth in the water constellations, when the flowers were more lasting, but when it went up to seed quicker in the air constellation, and faster seed ripening in the fire constellations. Now, because I didn't speak German, I didn't actually know any of this at the time. I just did the work of preparing the beds and sowing the seeds and cultivating the soil and spraying the biodynamic preparations, which I'll also mention later, in the correct element for each of the plots. And then everything looked the same to me, actually. I was young and didn't have much experience. But when it came time to harvest, I was deeply impressed by some of the differences that I saw in the different plots, particularly in the root plot. The form of the carrots and the beets was so beautiful. It was extraordinary. And they must have been bigger because I had to get a second crate out to harvest them. And then on the other end, what I was supposed to harvest the seeds from the calendula flowers, and I was picking them out of the decaying or drying flowers and from the three plots. But when I got to the seed, the fire one, there were no seeds. And that was terrible because I was supposed to collect them. And then I looked down, and the seeds had already ripened and fallen to the ground, and there was a carpet of germinated little calendula plants.
Wow.
And when I grasped, oh my gosh, that means that the fire influence is really stronger for seeds. And so that just convinced me. And after that, I just made my own calendar, and I sent it to my sister and a few friends, but coming back to America. And then eventually my husband said, you know, you put so much work in this thing, you might as well publish it. So that's how I got into it.
That's amazing. How many gardening seasons did you work on this project?
Well, only one. In
wow.
Switzerland. It was just the 1 year that I was there for 7 months for one gardening season, but it convinced me.
So it had to do with the moon being in those constellations, correct?
Right.
Is that part of the science behind the calendar? And you began to collect that data in when you started to publish it?
Well, I think in order to explain what it means to say the moon in the zodiac, I'm just going to give you and your readers a tiny bit of astronomy. We all know that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, and it's the same with the moon. But most people don't realize that at the same time that that daily rhythm is taking place, there is a much slower rhythm of the sun and the moon and all the planets moving gradually westward against the backdrop of the what we call the fixed stars or the zodiac. So even though the whole sky is rising from east and setting in the west, gradually the moon is moving westward amongst the stars. And so that's what it means when it says the moon is in a constellation. That means it's in front of a constellation of the zodiac. And these are traditionally assigned to the four elements.
Sherry, may I ask you, is that cycle that you're referring to, the moon moving westward, is that a monthly cycle or is that a longer cycle?
It is a monthly cycle.
Okay, so each month.
That's called the sidereal rhythm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So until it reaches, it's about a month, until it reaches the same star, yes. So it's in each of the constellations for 2 or 3 days. And because I work with the astronomical constellations rather than the sort of 30-degree equal pie slices that you can make, but Maria Toon discovered that the plants are related to the current events of the actual moon in front of the unequal constellations. The some are bigger than others.
I notice in the calendar that if one looks at the calendar, there are these grayed out days where there's nothing that is shown, no data shown of the astronomy. Why are some times grayed out?
Well, you actually can follow why, because I'm very committed that the things should be understandable. There's, for example, another rhythm of the moon, which is, it's called apogee and perigee. So the moon goes around the Earth in an elliptical form rather than a complete circle, even distances. And so there's a time when it's nearest to the Earth, that's called perigee, and then a time when it's farthest away, and that's called apogee. And when, you know, the moon has a strong relation to the water on the Earth, and that's an understatement if you think of the power to pull the water in the oceans with regard to the tides. So it has a very strong relation to water, and plants are so watery that if you, and this again is not my discovery, but Maria Toon's, that if you sow seeds when the moon is in perigee, when it's closest, then the watery influence is stronger than usual, and that tends to make plants more susceptible to fungus and pests. So I recommend that we don't sow seeds during that time, 12 hours before and 12 hours after perigee. And that's the same for eclipses. Even if the eclipse isn't visible in your part of the world, it's still happening to the whole Earth, and that has a very disturbing effect on the plants sown during the time of an eclipse. So that's another time when I gray out. At apogee, that's when the moon is farthest away, the plants sown at that time tend to bolt. And, you know, that's fine if you're growing flowers or string beans. You don't mind if it's going to seed quicker. But if you're sowing lettuce or spinach, it's not so good, or radishes. So then I avoid apogee. Also, I avoid the moon nodes. That's another lunar rhythm. But the times when the orbital plane of the moon crosses the ecliptic, which is the orbital plane of the sun, those crossing points are not such great times for sowing seeds.
We've experienced some of this at our farm, and we've used the Stella Natura for years, and we have one very amazing story that goes along with what you're saying, I think, that my father experienced.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that, because we took one. I like to plant my peas in 50-cell trays, because I like to transplant them rather than just putting them out in the field. So we took 50 peas and put them in a tray without even paying attention to the calendar, which was very stupid of me. But I noticed in a week that only one had come up, one of 50. And I said, what in the world's going on? So I went back to the calendar, and sure enough, I had planted them right in the middle of a 12-hour gray period. And so I said, okay, fine. I use the same seeds out of the same packet, leave the same soil in there, and wait for a fruit day to come up. And I did. And 3 days later, a fruit day came up. And in the meantime, I had looked at some of the other pea seeds that didn't come up, and they'd sort of rotted out, and they just weren't going to do anything. So I planted the other 49 in there on 3 days later on a fruit day, and in 3 days they were all up. That was astounding. 3 days, all the other 49 are up, the same seeds out of the same packet in the same soil, but waiting until a fruit day showed up. That was astounding, and I like to talk about that, as anybody says, what is the advantage of the calendar. So we have managed to get a whole lot of people oriented on your calendar, Sherry. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That's great.
Might be a good time for you to mention about biodynamic agriculture and what the background of that is.
Yeah, are there other elements other than coordinating with the astrological constellations, you know, the cosmic forces, so to speak?
Well, there are other aspects to the calendar as such, in that every year there are articles for every month, and also in the beginning pages, first the explanation of how to use it. It's for beginners, so it's not something that you have to be an astronomer for. You can just, it's an easy-to-use calendar, but I would read the first pages. But yes, I put a lot of effort into putting articles in the calendar to stimulate healthy agriculture for the future.
So what is biodynamic farming? Are there other aspects to it other than...
Yes, absolutely.
Could you go into those?
So we've heard about the cosmic rhythms, but also one of the most important things is the recognition that plants themselves cannot be ill. It's always an environmental reason why the plants are weak, and that there's not a distinct boundary between the life of the plant roots and the life of the soil that they're growing in. So already in 1924, when Rudolf Steiner gave these lectures, he was describing the effects of the mycorrhizal fungi and all the symbiotic relationships between the plants and the soil, and that the fundamental effort of biodynamics is to enliven the solid earth, to bring that soil to life, because he works and speaks very much about the life forces in the soil and in the plant, and plants can be more vital or less And we see that. And that affects also nutrition. It's an entirely different view of nutrition, not merely quantitative description of the substances in the food, but the vitality of the food is what's important, the actual quality of what's being grown, and that is what nourishes us or doesn't.
In just a crude demarcation, if you would, does biodynamic necessarily involve no chemical pesticides or herbicides?
Yes. So it's said to stay within the realm of the living. So that means no chemical fertilizers.
So
and that,
yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, so basically what I'm trying to get to there is we can assume that if some farmer presents his product at a farmer's market and says this is a biodynamic farm, that you're basically dealing with organic produce.
Yes. And it goes further than organics. It recognizes that we want to not just imitate nature, but that nature actually needs healing at this point, and that there are certain preparations, herbal preparations, that where you gather the substances right, you know, basically from a farm if you have a full farm, but from nature, and create these various compost preparations or spray preparations to help the plant growth. It's kind of like medicine for the earth.
We're speaking with Sherry Wildfair, who is the originator of the Stella Natura calendar, which became available to the public in 1978 for the first time, and is published, is it yearly? You put it out yearly with...
Every year, and it's available. You can look it up online as www.stellanatura.com or info@stellanatura. It's available for sale from us.
Okay. Sherry, the Camp Hill Village in Kimberton Hills, where you are, is the publisher. Can you tell us a little bit more about that community and what are the aims of Camp Hill?
Yes, well, we're one of 12 communities in North America, Camp Hill communities, and there are over 100 in 22 different countries worldwide. We have common ideals. We integrate children there's one school in America, or adults. In our community, it's adults with special learning needs or disabilities. And we practice life sharing in family-style households. So we all live together in our homes rather than being clients and, I don't know, caregivers or something. And we always care for the land with biodynamic practices. And we try to be models in our social forms for a more humane future. So we have certain... social ideals that we practice in Camp Hill worldwide. In our place, we have, we're all volunteers, so that one of the ideals is that we separate the money we need to live from the labor or the contribution that we make in the community. So we get what we need from the community, but we participate according to our abilities. And so there's lots of opportunities to volunteer here. We have a big CSA garden, a dairy farm, an orchard, a herb garden, cafe, bakery, weavery, mosaic studio, and of course there's lots of cooking and cleaning to be done. And there's a special house dedicated to elder care. We're always open at the moment, looking for an orchardist, and I mean we have one, but someone to help with the orchard, and somebody who would like to join the team in the elder care house.
Sherry, do you have any protégés with you on this calendar? Because I suspect that there are other people that have ideas on how to join the cosmic rhythms with soil growing and so forth.
Well, I have two younger friends who are interested in learning how to do it and carrying on when I can't. If that's what you meant by proteges,
That's what I meant.
Well, this Campmore Village sounds amazing. Is there
Camp Hill?
I'm sorry, Camp Hill Village.
CAMPHILL. There's also a website, camphill.org, for all the Camp Hill communities.
That's what I was going to get to. Yes. Yeah. So people who want to find more about it can go to camphillvillage.org. Is that right?
Camphill.org is the one for the whole region of North America. And then I think it's camphillkimberton.org is our village, Kimberton Hills.
How near are you to larger communities, urban communities? Or are you way out there in the boondocks, or are you?
No, we're not in the boondocks at all. We're less than an hour away from Philadelphia, depending on traffic.
Nice.
And we're near Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, which is not a metropolis, but it's certainly a town, and Pottstown. No, we're not isolated. But we do have a 420-acre farm, so in that sense, we're rural.
Yeah, that is a patch of land. That's a lot of. So how many people are actually in residence there and are involved?
120 people live here.
Mm-hmm.
That includes children, old people, all volunteers, and people who have special needs.
Sherry, do you put out any sort of a seed catalog or anything that people could buy into besides the calendar itself?
There is Turtle Tree.
Oh, yes. We deal with Turtle Tree. Absolutely. They're up here.
They sell biodynamic seeds, and they have their operation in another Camp Hill village in Copaic, New York, upstate New York.
Yeah, we deal with them. Absolutely. We've been up there, too. Right.
That's
Sherry,
great.
I just want to mention that our time is very short, and this conversation is, I would say, about a third done. There's so much more to talk about.
Right.
So I don't know if you've enjoyed yourselves, but we've enjoyed you immensely, and we hope that you will come back and continue this with us. And,
well, it's been a pleasure. It's my first time on the radio ever.
You got a great radio voice, so
thank you.
Share it some more with us, please.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Sherry.
We'll be in touch and try to set up another date for you sometime before the hot heat of the summer really grips.
Sherry, one last call. How many calendars do you put out every year? In other words,
we print about 8,000.
Good show.
Excellent.
Right, wow. Excellent. So we take in about 50 of those because we could get them at a reduced price, but I know you have to sell them at a retail price, but that's always been.
As you say, you can get them. There's a discount when you buy them in bulk.
Right. Good.
Well, we're devoted users of Stella Natura. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Sherry. Talk to you soon.
Yes.
And this has been...
Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is the Organic Farm Stand. We will be back in 2 weeks. My name is Richard Hill, here with Guy Beardsley and Janelle Beardsley. They'll be back too. And so join us. Don't forget about the Winter Conference, NOFA Winter Conference, coming up on March 7th in Middletown, Connecticut, Wesleyan University. We're going to be talking about that in depth on our next show. Thanks for listening.
I'm FDA approved. Organic love. Oh, 100% natural. Well, well, well.
Programming support comes from New Morning Market, family-owned in Woodbury since 1971, specializing in local and organic with fresh produce, grass-fed meat, farmstead cheeses, foods for special diets, and healthy dishes prepared daily. NewMorningMarket.com.
Support for WPKN comes from the Klein in Bridgeport, celebrating Black History Month with a performance of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, starring Bridgeport native Ta-Nehisi Davis and directed by Maureen Hamill, on Thursday, February 6th at 7 p.m. More information and tickets at theklein.org or through the Klein box office at 1-800-424-0100. 1-800-273-8760.
This Thursday, February 6th, join WPKN for our 22nd edition of the Underground Series at the Acoustic in Bridgeport. For a $10 donation, come and enjoy musical performances by Electric Beast, Vinny the Space Cowboy, John Paul Lewis, and Barbara. The doors open at 7 and music starts at 8. The Acoustic is located at 2926 Fairfield Avenue in Bridgeport. For more information, go to theacoustic.rocks or WPKN.org. That's this Thursday, February 6th.
This week on Digging in the Dirt, my guest will be Dan Martins, Vice President of Novamont North America, a company dedicated to the production of bioplastics and bioproducts of renewable origins. Hi, I'm Kevin Gallagher, host of Digging in the Dirt, and it's my belief that we aren't getting out of this environmental mess we find ourselves in without the help of corporations willing to make the necessary changes needed. Novamont is one such company and a leader in developing compostable bioplastics that could help humanity wean itself off the scourge of single-use plastics. Tune in to Digging in the Dirt here on WPKN Monday the 10th at 5 p.m. to hear how other progressive-thinking companies you may even shop at have opted to provide their customers with compostable produce bags made from materials developed by Novamont, only on listener-supported WPKN. How to let go of the world and love all the things climate can't change. The next film in our WPKN Environmental Film Series, it will be screened February 10th at 7:30 p.m. at the Bijou Theater in downtown Bridgeport. And coming up at future dates will be the films Climate Refugees, Tomorrow, A Plastic Ocean, and Shark Water. Make the second Monday of every month the night you come to see one of these thought-provoking films in WPKN's Environmental Film Series at the Bijou Theater in downtown Bridgeport.
Hi, I'm Lou with Citizens Campaign for the Environment, here to tell you how you can protect our water by properly disposing of unused prescription medications.
Prescription medications? What does the way I dispose of my old drugs have to do with protecting our water?
Everything. Most people still don't know that the old method of flushing unused medications contaminates Long Island Sound with steroids, hormones, and antibiotics.
Wow.
This affects our drinking water, rivers, harbors, and it affects our aquatic wildlife too.
That's awful. I want cream and sugar in my coffee, not steroids and antidepressants. Pharmaceuticals in the water can't be good for fish. What can I do to help?
Well, the good news is that towns across the state are offering new locations for residents to safely and anonymously dispose of their unused and expired drugs. If your town does not have a disposal program, you can always crush tablets or empty capsules into the garbage.
How do I find out more?
Visit citizenscampaign.org to find a safe disposal location near you and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
I get it. Don't flush your drugs.
Hi, I'm Samantha Danowski, director of Sierra Club Connecticut. Sierra Club's the nation's oldest and largest environmental organization, and our state chapter has been around since 1972. We value a livable planet, clean air, clean water, wild places, wildlife,